This week's show was brought to you by Chad Sawyer and Randy Tallow. If you too would like to become a sponsor, simply head on over to patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your tiny contribution of just $5 a month will earn you all your shows a tiny bit early. Bonus, members-only content each month, and while supplies last, to our first 50 new and existing Patreons, a high-quality 5x5 vinyl sticker featuring our illustrious cover art. If you would like to fully immerse yourself in this week's episode, make sure to pick up a copy of The Dive Manual, an empirical investigation of mysticism by our good friend, Mr. Anthony Tyler. It's on Amazon for a reasonable price, and if you're on quarantine like myself, face it, you've got nothing better to do. It's a great read at a good price. So, check it out, people. This was our first episode and interview with a published author on the show, so you can tell I'm a little bit nervous. Nonetheless, it was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Nice, dude. Hell yeah. Right on.
Okay, I gotta remember. We gotta do introductions. After I do the introduction. Okay. I know what I'm doing here. See, I use Right Monkey and Audacity because I'm a professional.
Hell yeah, man.
I like the typewriter ticky tick 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 noise. It makes me feel like I'm writing something important, but it's usually just whatever.
Dude, I've always wanted to buy a typewriter and like actually pump out a manuscript on that. One of these days.
Have you used one?
That's so awesome.
No, not yet.
You've never used a typewriter? I used to use a typewriter in middle school all the time because I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
They're kind of awkward.
I loved it. I fucking loved it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just snorkel about and get suntanned on our precious butts. Hell no. We don a mystic dive suit with a harpoon of laser-like directed will and descend down, down into the dank undercurrents of the psyche, systematically slapping sirens and subterfuging succubi, because today we are joined by the Jacques Cousteau of Psychic Depths, author of The Dive Manual and harbinger of this week's discussion, the holy diver himself, Anthony Tyler. How you doing tonight, Mr. Tyler?
Hey, I'm doing great, man. I appreciate the Dio reference, and that was a great introduction overall. Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me, guys. You know, I love having conversations like this whenever I get the chance.
We heard you on the Abracast, which is like our dark older brother podcast.
Nice. I love the Abracast. John is a really cool dude. I got nothing but good things to say about him.
It was fun listening to you guys talk because you guys had like, you know, it was like everything on the list you guys were ready to talk about. Like everything in your book you guys touched on. I don't know if we'll get there today, but I can say that you've spent a lot of time in the Midnight Sea. Would that be the case?
Yeah. I could definitely attest to that. It's honestly some people look at things like spiritualism as like eccentric power, and I guess that there's something to be said about that. You certainly get more of a grip of your personal capability when you look into this kind of stuff, if you do it right, that is. But I got into it out of necessity, you know, because it was either write this book and, you know, research the contents of this book or kind of lose my mind. You know, it's a slippery slope sometimes. Life gets the best of you. So because of that, I can say that I've spent a lot of time in the depths. I'll kind of preface the conversation by saying, you know, the whole metaphor of the dive and dive manual is not only exploring the depths of the unconscious mind, which would be the depths of the water metaphorically, but also, you know, the idea that the depths of the ocean are unknown and perilous. And I certainly agree with premises like, you know, just peace and happiness and love. Like I'm a hippie in that sense, but I have to be adamant about the fact that
there's something you don't like about follow your bliss, right? There's something about the ooey gooey, like, oh, if I don't like it, I just ignore it until it goes away. Like
exactly. 100%, because that doesn't work. You can't ignore it. It will not go away. And so you have to get dirty sometimes. And that doesn't mean dirty like black magic type stuff. That means dirty as in, you know, just unfiltered and being ready to, you know, let come what may.
Basically,
so
work with your shadow in some
way. Face your demons.
100. Yeah. Face your demons. Yeah. Work with the shadow. Both 100% on point. Absolutely.
And we kind of mean like shadow in the Carl Jung sense. And I do want to get into that because you bring up anima and animus in the book. The Dive Manual, it's called, by the way, The Empirical Investigations of Mysticism. And it seems like you put a great deal of work into explaining the underpinnings and the workings that, you know, make up these mechanisms of the psyche. And I don't know, I kind of want to ask you a little bit about that, like kind of get into the, if the mind were a car, we'd get underneath the hood and start breaking it. I mean, looking at it and figuring it out, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Shoot away, man. Where would you like to start?
I couldn't help but notice, like, Hermes himself said to, like, write the book. It's kind of dope. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that is a great place to start because we can get down to the meat of it right off the bat. And I don't know personally how much or if any of, so to speak, are sentient, because, you know, there's a difference between autonomy and sentience.
Let's talk about that. What is it? What do you? Okay, so like, so we're talking about archetypes in the psyche, right?
Right.
And the difference between autonomy and sentience. So, like, what do you mean? Let's break that down. What do you mean by that? Like, what's the difference, you think?
So, autonomy is essentially something like a software program where it's self-directing and self-motivated, self-guided, but there's not necessarily any a priori. You know, there's no self-awareness, so to speak, like with a software program. So.
So I might
essentially
call it like algorithmic consciousness. It just obeys a certain function. And it doesn't have any like random variance. It just operates based on its programming and doesn't update or change, or, you know, it's not really alive in any, like, as we would think of it.
Absolutely. And from the point I'm about to make is a little bit of like a personal assessment of mine, but I see the network of archetypes, something like the animal kingdom, where
Cool.
I wouldn't consider a termite very sentient. For example, I mean, obviously not an animal, but you get the gist. And whereas a dolphin, apparently very self-aware, surprisingly self-aware. So I think that the archetypes, you know, there's no way to prove this at the current time, but I think it's at least a safe theoretical bet that some archetypes are probably as sentient as dolphins. You know, they're self-aware in different ways, whereas others probably have very little to no self-awareness at all. But then again, there could be no self-awareness. There's really no way to tell from our point of view. And so when I do something, like I sit down with some candles and I say some hymns and I meditate on the concept of Hermes, I don't really know what's going on, but that isn't really the point in the long run. The point is this, you know, it's almost like watching a movie or just experiencing great art in general. There's this sense of suspended disbelief, and that really is the crux of it. Is I think that it's healthy for anyone dabbling in this stuff to not take it too serious. Like, you don't want to
confuse the planes. That's like what I want.
Yes, 100%. You hit the nail on the head. Yeah, you don't want to confuse the planes. You got to keep things, you know, you got to cross your T's and dot your I's, so to speak. But
that's actually a pretty big, without spoiling it, there's a bit of a plot point. I think that's the right word. That's an arc in the book you wrote is how to deal with that, like dealing with things on their plane. And their correct plane without like confusing them.
Right. Well, that was a serious crux for me in my life, a crossroads, if you will, where And that's one thing. That's one reason why I am such a fan of H.P. Lovecraft and the concepts found within existential horror in general, because that's the threshold of existential horror where you don't really know what's going on. You know, you don't, and that's even the threshold of psychosis. That's the definition of clinical psychosis, where you can't interpret the outside world from the inside world. And the more you start to slice that pie, the more, I don't know, you don't really know where you are to begin with, because the outside and the inner world have a very fluid line to begin with. So
so in your text, so let me get this right. So just so this is kind of like, you got to check me, make sure I'm understanding what I read. So sure. As you make connections with these forces and potentially, what would they call them? Preternatural intelligences, archetypes that existed before us and will exist after us. As we make connections with those archetypes, we impose our own overlays on them, our own psychological projections. And you kind of explain it that as we make connections with those things, and even as we lose connections with those things, it's like gaining a psychic limb and then like losing it. Is that kind of like when you make a connection with the other side, it's like creating more of yourself. And that's kind of like a psychic limb. Do I have that kind of right? Or how would you explain the concept of psychic limb?
I'd say you got it pretty well on point, but I will elaborate a little more and say that. See, you talked about the psychic limbs. I'm sorry. What was there's a first part to that question. What was it again?
Oh boy, I hope I can remember.
So
it's like you're reaching out and you're making contact with these archetypes, right? And you're kind of like, they don't have a face yet, and so you kind of put a face on them, so to speak. You give them a form.
Right. So I think that bar none, the best scientific example of what we're talking about here is sleep paralysis and the phenomena associated with it.
Oh, that's such a good topic. We haven't even really talked about that shit on this show.
Oh, my God. I've had the worst experience with that.
You have? Oh, yes, my God. Okay. No, keep going. Keep going, Mr. Tyler.
Hey, no sweat. I'm consistently surprised at how many people have sleep paralysis events. And it's very common. You know, it doesn't matter if you're an atheist or a devout Christian or anything in between, people have sleep paralysis events. I've had a couple of them, but they were when I was a kid and they didn't get too surreal, but I know the feeling for sure. I've dabbled with my own demons in different ways, but sleep paralysis is specifically interesting because the more you look into it, the more you see that there are indicators, there are psychological indicators, and psychological indicators are more often than not psychosomatic, meaning that they're connected to the body as well. And we'll get into that a little bit later, how these things have biological correlates, because it's a little bit implicit.
I remember in Prometheus Rising, Robert Anton Wilson says that problems with like the first circuit, the biosurvival circuit, they feel like they're all over the body like all at once. I remember him saying something like that. That just kind of popped into my head as you were saying that.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And that's right along the lines of the stuff I'll be bringing up. Like my favorite example of sleep paralysis and even the phantom limbs, which go hand in hand in this case, because there was a famous neuroscientist named V.S. Ramachandran who wrote the book Phantoms in the Brain and has written other stuff. And he's also done clinical research into sleep paralysis and observed how essentially it appears that our brains are projecting, you know, they're coming from the visual cortex in the brain.
That like part of the brain near the back, it's like coming from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the reason that these things come across as people, you know, shadow people, is because it's dealing with the same circuitry that allows you to view regular people essentially and have dreams about regular people and so forth. So
much like your limbs are attached to your limbic system, is these entities so too are attached to your limbic system in some way, or they're at least attached to your nervous system somewhere, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And this is a very Freemasonic notion as well. Really? I don't know how much, either of you have looked into Manly Palmer Hall, but there's so much literature and, you know, audio lectures of Manly Hall's material online. He set up the Philosophical Research Society. He was a 33rd degree Mason of the Scottish Rite. This guy, very well versed and not really pushy either. You know, he doesn't have an agenda. You can hear it in his words, whether it's written or spoken. He's just trying to put across information. And, you know, this is a bit of an aside, so I won't go into this because, you know, we're trying to make another point. But it seems pretty clear that Manly Hall was actually killed by some sort of Freemasonic organization.
Oh, really? Know, did he go out with some sort of a sign, like hung from a bridge or with the shoelaces or something like that? I don't remember.
Metaphorically, yes, because what actually happened is he went out. He was very old, like in his late 80s or early 90s or something, and he had a caretaker. And that caretaker did some really ambiguous things, stealing money and different stuff. And they went on like this strange road trip where him and his wife were separated, and he was being driven by the caretaker. And long story short, by the end of it, they found him days later. He was so dead that there were ants living in his mouth.
Damn.
So dude, there's some weird foul play going on for sure.
He got Kaepernicked.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the point about
phantom limbs and shadow people.
Because
I've never really had.
Right.
I've woken up with sleep paralysis a few times, but I've definitely never had anything come and sit on my chest, so to speak. I remember once falling asleep, and I heard a bunch of shit crashing around in the garage, and I had one moment of lucidity where I was like, "No, that's not real. This is part of the transition." And then I fucking fell asleep. I'm just so good at that shit.
See, mine was so, like, mine involved more than just shadow people. Like, mine, like, I couldn't breathe. I had pressure on my chest. I felt, like, heat, and I felt, like, I saw the glow of flames. And I felt, like, the demonic energy. And I literally just started reciting Bible verses because I didn't know what else to do. And as soon as I started, like, reciting Bible verses, it all just, like, stopped.
Why does everyone say that works? Should we ask that on the whole rabbit? Like, why the fuck does everyone say that shit works?
That's a great question. And see, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I can see two viewpoints to that. One is psychologically we're raised from a very young age. If we're born into a Christian religion, that Bible verses work for things. So psychologically we use Bible verses.
It would probably work with Krishna if you were.
Or
you
two,
know.
It actually is demonic forces and the Bible, you know, works.
And we talked in our last episode, like the Mahayana Buddhists use wrathful deities to drive out, these entities.
Or maybe it's a little
right.
Bit of
I love that.
So okay. Yeah, so anyway, yeah. So why do you think that shit works? What's up? What do you?
I think that it's a little bit of a middle ground between the two explanations you gave. And see, there's some scientific studies. It's still being fleshed out a little bit, but there's certainly enough data to suggest or to evidence the fact that placebo works even if you know it's happening.
Okay, so that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it's less, but it certainly works on a demonstrable, a tangible level that's observable and shouldn't be discounted. So, and personally, I think that can be, you know, that entails hypnotic capability. You know, the more that you're able to tap into that, the more that you'll be able to find use out of that, like a placebo while still knowing that it's a placebo. And that's kind of what magic is, in a sense. I'm not trying to be reductionist about it or discredit the idea, but from a scientific perspective, it's like I'm saying before about the notion of suspended disbelief. There's neurological underpinnings behind that. But as to the Bible verses, I think, you know, so with sleep paralysis, I've never heard of an example ever where someone has been able to stand up to the shadow people phenomena and have them still stick around. You know, once you draw that line, whether it's Bible verses or, you know, pick your weapon, so to speak.
Very,
yeah, but once
very cool.
Yeah, once you toe that line, it seems like time and time again they will leave. And it's that idea of being drawn to fear, like a shark sniffing blood in the water or something. And I think that's how most of these mechanisms, these archetypal mechanisms, operate, whether it's good or bad. You know, these positive archetypes will be attracted to love and compassion and empathy, like a shark to blood in the water. You know what I mean? So it's I think that there's to answer your question earlier, these things, how we interact with them, it seems like good or bad, they piggyback, essentially.
Oh, there's interesting. Yeah,
it's either parasitic or mutualistic. I think there's a third one in that category.
Symbiotic, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's it right there. Yeah, and I think that all of those three things apply in these cases, given the specific examples. And sleep paralysis, and so those are essentially the biological underpinnings. Is they're feeding off of natural neurological, even biological mechanisms. Like, I'll give you my personal example. You know, throughout the book, I had encounters in my dreams with what I call the siren, which actually has not only mythological significance, but we can go into it a little bit. The Greeks had a lot to say about how the siren, in a folklore sense, impacted their daily life. You know, it's not just
their daily life.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Let's get into that for a minute. That sounds interesting. Just dive into that. So, like, the siren, like, how did their, okay, so their notion of the siren and daily life. So, like, if they felt maybe drawn to something with, like, an overabundance of passion, they might be like, oh, fuck, this is gonna whoop my ass. This is gonna kill me.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And more specifically even, this was something that I just stumbled across. So I was really surprised to even find the connections, but demonstrably, the idea of the siren in antiquated Greek culture is the same, is like an inversion of the sleep paralysis shadow people, because the siren was said to be a dream entity that came to you during the day.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and see the shadow person, the succubus or incubus, is something that's drawn by fear, and the siren is drawn by not love, so to speak, but this idea of entrancement. You know, this thing, this fine line between, like, it's certainly not evil in the sense of it's coming to, like, quote unquote, steal your soul or something, but, you know, in the as it's portrayed in Greek mythology, the sirens are so beautiful and illustrious that they'll have you jumping overboard, you know, from your ship into the water, swimming to their shoreline and dying at their feet. You know, like, you will literally just wait there on the shoreline, listening to their songs, waiting for them to show you some sort of attention until you die. So, and that's kind of that's the motif behind it. Is,
yeah, there's definitely some things in life like that.
Yeah, amen, man. 100%. Yeah, you see, and that is one of the crux difficulties I have with swallowing this whole follow your bliss pill is
you're just like, right. Oh shit, you're gonna end up on the rocks, fucker.
Yeah, amen, amen. And so, like I said, I certainly think that bliss and peace and love should be the outcomes, but you got to be prepared to get a little dirty, because things are not as they seem. You know, they never are, hardly.
God, I want to jump in, like, five different directions. It's so frustrating. Like, I want to talk about, like, five different things at once, man. Man, can we – okay, so we're talking shit on New Age. Let's go there for a minute. Okay, so I was, without getting too explicit, because I love these people and I've worked out most of my things with them, and if I haven't, we don't harass each other, and I don't think we'll ever talk again. So with that in mind, I used to have, like, a group of people, and some of us were really listening to a lot of this New Age shit, like Abraham Hicks, Bashar, right? And there's a few others. And as time went on, at first, I got to this place with it where I was like, man, my life is fucked up. You know, like, my life is trash, you know? I think that this is kind of like a weird hedonistic philosophy, and I just kind of discarded it. And later, after kind of like giving it some time and some just empty meditation, and basically, I had to put my fucking life back together, because, like, I kind of exploded my life with that stuff without getting too explicit, and I totally had to put my life back together. I definitely, like, I had a moment in a garage, you know, where there's no hope, and you're just laying down, and you're just like, oh, fuck, because you have a moment like that in your book in the RV. It, like, you go, like, right, somehow following your bliss, like you said, like the siren, it takes you to the absolute fucking depths. Like, if you chase the dragon, you know, like, if you chase pleasure, it's going to lead to displeasure. That's like almost a fact of life. So I guess where I'm going with this, though, is after I fixed my fucking life a little bit and moved away from that philosophy, I went back and I looked at it again, and I noticed there was some stuff that I don't like. Maybe there's some truth to it, and it's harder to interpret than they're selling it to be.
Yeah. Well, to start off, there's a phrase I like to use that if you're going to be chasing dragons, you better be prepared to slay them.
Woo!
And I think I don't mean to put down New Age too much, because, like you said, there is a certain bit of utility in it.
Well, let's get our fingers dirty, dude. What do you think those things are channeling? Those people, like when they're channeling those entities, are those archetypes? Are those phantom limbs? Are they tricksters? Like, are they fucking aliens? Like, what's coming through, dude, in those New Age like channelers?
Well, that's a great question, and this is the problem with it, is I don't think that there are enough control methods to even say, really. It's such a case by case basis. Some people seem genuine, and other people seem like they're just trying to sell books or whatever other media, and other people seem like they're just in it for the ego trip. So I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, I think that the reason I'm so averse to New Age is because of that, what I said right there. But if someone finds use in a specific researcher, I guess my recommendation would be like, really suss that out, you know, research the person that you're interested in. You know, I found inspiration in people like Manly Hall and Carl Jung, among others, and I researched the hell out of those guys. I wanted to know as much as I possibly could about their personal history, just because if I'm going to data dump my mind with all sorts of stuff, I want to know who's doing it. And I don't think enough people ask those questions. And
I think you're right, man. I think I'm one of those people, because like you said, you're talking about Manly P. Hall. And like, when I got into the Theosophical Library, I went straight to of course I'm on air, so I can't think of his name. This is how this works. Transcendental Magic, Eliphas Levi. For some reason, classic. I kept going to Eliphas Levi, Carl Jung, and just any book I could get about the Kabbalah. You know, like I loved anything I could get my hands on about the Kabbalah. And when I got into that, it really obsessed me, because I wanted to understand the anatomy of the soul, basically. I felt like there was something important there. Like, if I could understand the distinct anatomy of the soul, I might be able to unlock its secrets myself, right? So here's the thing. I'm just going to play devil's advocate, because I just wanted to do this for the show, up for the New Age. So like Abraham Hicks, Bashar, whatever, the thing that they say that makes sense to me and all the other stuff I've said is like, when they say that sense of excitement, or that sense of, I don't know if bliss is the word, but Bashar says excitement and moving towards the thing that excites you the most, that is you. That sense of like joy and happiness and whatever, that's like, that is the core of what you are. Like, that's their premise. And what I found interesting about that is that like, that sort of riffs a little bit with what Aleister Crowley was saying in Thelema and the Book of the Law. Like, there's so much in that book where it's like, you know, I'm not of the fallen. I'm not of the dogs dying in the gutter, you know? Like it's about like conquering, and maybe there's a deeper message here of like the nature of our soul or of our spirit is like fiery and conquering, and that's what they're channeling, and it's like elemental in nature, so it doesn't really take part in our earthly problems, and so it might not understand them necessarily. I don't know. Once again, confusing the planes.
You know, I think that excitement is a much better word than bliss, because if I recommend anybody follow anything, I would say it's your intuition. You know,
I love that. I love that, man.
Thanks, man. I can honestly say I've gotten a lot of use out of that. You know, sometimes your intuition will I don't know. It's not always cut and dry, I guess you could say, but I've never been led astray following that. You know, sometimes you might follow a gut feeling, and then a situation might not turn out the way you intended. But if you let that blossom a little bit more, in my cases, at least, I've always come to feel grateful for those.
Dude,
decisions.
I've found it to be so true. What were we going to say, Brittany?
Oh, I was just going to ask, speaking of intuition, what are your thoughts on people that can have visions that come true? You think they're just freaks of nature?
That's a great question, because I don't fully know. I mean, no one does really, but my best stab in the dark would be, I don't know, the brains are essentially biological radios. You know, they're emitting Hertz waves the same way as radios. So I think that sometimes, given your state of consciousness, because there are way more varying states of consciousness than we as humans understand. So I think that you can tap into certain things. I don't know if it's a parallel universe thing, or, you know, it could be it just depends on how you want to slice that pie. There are different explanations at this point.
Because you had that happen in your book. You had something happen in your dream, and then the almost exact same thing occurred in your life.
Yeah. Still mind-blowing to this day. And I'll go ahead and say this real quick. For anyone who does read the book,
yes,
there's some things that I'm very open about that it's a little bit semi-fictional, in the sense that I didn't want to bore people with semantics in my personal life. So in some cases, I kind of splice some events together and whatnot. But in terms of my dreams and the just the event, you know, like the different cryptids I saw that we can get into.
Oh, let's save that for the end, man. That's so good. Oh my God. Don't tempt me, dude. Oh my God. Okay. Where were we going for that? Okay.
The dream coming true.
Dreams coming true. Dreams coming true. Okay. And I'm going to tie that back into talking shit on New Age. I promise.
Right on, right on. Oh yeah. To wrap up that point real quick, all the exclamatory points in the plot are, you know, you can only take my word for it, but they're completely genuine. And that's another reason why I made the book a little semi-fictional, because I don't care if people believe me or not. I really don't. It's about the data and the points that I'm trying to get across. So
we're pretty open-minded on this show, man.
Right on, right.
We're just gonna take your word for it, man. It's not even a question, dude. Like,
cool. Well, yeah, I appreciate that, guys. So for the listeners that haven't had a chance to read any material yet, the short of it is, I had a dream about this soon to be ex-girlfriend, and it was essentially a dream of me meeting her in a carnival, and then I met her at essentially a carnival, a bona fide carnival. It was like this this college event where there was different music and there's all sorts of tents and stuff. So it wasn't like a traditional like P.T. Barnum style like circus or something.
But it was like the material manifestation of what you saw in the astral in your dream.
Absolutely. I mean, I 100% think that. And I even met her in the same ways that I did in the dream. And she looked exactly the same. So I ended up meeting her about like 3 months later. And that was just this whole snowball effect. She's a really great person. You know, we still talk sometimes, but as those things go, it's hard to stay consistent with people like that. Once they're out of your life, they're kind of just, that's how life goes. You know, things move on, time rolls on, but I still got nothing but good things to say about Ramona. She's a sweetheart. She's a saint, practically, a hell of a person. And she was interested.
I have a synchronicity that relates because, like, you're our first published author on our show. And it's really fun to be talking to somebody that I haven't met before online and, like, sharing ideas. I thought it was really synchronistic because I'm working on a, I don't know if you can see this. I'm working on a carnival room, a carnival escape room.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, it's supposed to be, like, sunset and, like, man, when you were explaining your dream and you were, like, lost inside a carnival with all these clothes, I was like, that is literally the fucking escape room I'm building.
Nice, dude. Like, I get that vibe, too. I totally feel it. I appreciate that. That's awesome.
That just blew my mind. I was like, okay, well, there's the synchronicity. And that's what I think the world is made of. I think the world is made of dreams. I think this is all bullshit, man. Like, I don't think this material stuff is real. I think when you said, like, you say something in your book, like, when you went into that world, there's a quality of it that's more real than this world.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing to shake, too. Carl Jung actually had a near-death experience undergoing some sort of foot surgery, I believe. And
that sucks.
he ended up slipping for a while.
What's up, Brittany?
Dude, we laugh because I literally have a cast on right now, and I find out on the 30th if I have to have foot surgery or not.
Another synchronicity. Thanks, Jung.
I don't think there's... Yeah. And that was in no later than the middle of the 20th century. So you got decades of medical science to back you up on that.
Okay. Did you talk about this near-death experience in the book or do I just...
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
A little bit. Yeah. The point I'd like to make there, it's a very interesting experience, but afterward, when he's resuscitated, he says that I can't remember the time period, but it was at least a couple weeks, he said, where it wasn't like he was suicidal by any stretch of the imagination, but he had lost the like vigor and the zeal of life. You know, he said he would look at like a beautiful landscape out his window, like a mountains and a sunset, and it just looked like a painting. You know, it didn't seem to have any realism to it. And I think that, I don't know, man, that's kind of like one of the million-dollar questions of life is like, how real is all this and how serious should we take it? And I don't know. You know, it doesn't seem all that real.
It seems most real when you're suffering, unfortunately.
And that's another good point is that it's almost like the realism of it varies from time to time, and I think that has to do a little bit with our state of consciousness and the various aspects of free will. Because I think that free will does exist, but I think that it's very nuanced, and I don't think that I think that every human being is being forced into certain things psychologically at times. You know, that's just. It's just how the mind works. That's, you know, your neurology is like a railroad track. It's just going to keep going. You can't abolish it unless you do some serious brain damage. So,
or meditation maybe.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. That's a different bag of worms as well. Like, you know, the neuroplasticity in and of itself, whether it's meditation or psychedelics, but psychedelics are a bit of a slippery slope. You got to really know what you're doing with those. Man, there's so many topics. What was the question you proposed?
Oh, you know, we were talking, you know what I really want to ask you is like about the anatomy of the soul. Okay. Like, cause we're talking, I don't know what we're talking about, but anima, I'm so high. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, what's up everybody?
I love it, man. This is great.
I need a weed sponsor for crying out loud.
Fuck yeah.
Anima and Animus, okay?
Anima?
Oh, man. Like the Tool album.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Man, I thought Tool was my favorite band until Rammstein released their latest album. Like,
I haven't checked that out yet. I'm going to have to check it out.
Oh, man. Word. Well, Tempest was amazing. Moving on.
Sure was.
Fucking... So... Anima and animus. You mentioned those in the book, and it's you almost talk about them like they're part of the anatomy of the soul. Like, and you kind of mentioned this concept that what is it, like, the like males ought to develop more their anima, and then women ought to maybe more develop their animus. Let's not get too into the gender thing, but that's like a general idea. What is the anima and what is the animus? Just to ask flat out.
Yeah, and you know, I think that the gender conversation convolutes this a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't mean to do that.
No. That's a great thing to bring up because it's one of the biggest misconceptions about this whole thing. You know, the masculine and feminine principles of the psyche are not so much like sexual or gender oriented as they are just energy. You know, you think of it more as like the proton and the electron more than what we consider male and female today, because that's how the esotericists of antiquity considered it. And
so like, where would you map an anima and an animus, like where an esotericist would, or would those be like the male and female, like, because you know Kundalini is broken into, oh, with the Ida and the Pingala, it's like a, you know, a cold serpent and then the fire serpent. You know,
right.
And like, are these like alchemical opposites in our mind? Is like one the conscious and one the subconscious? You know,
yes.
Is that how you'd put it?
Yeah. There are a few different ways that you could break it down, all of which, you know, go hand in hand with each other. And I think that the best start would be the conscious and unconscious. Now, the masculine is the active principle, meaning that that's something that. And like I said, don't boil this down to sexual orientation by any stretch of the imagination.
Right,
you
got
to think of it more as a proton and electron situation. And so the masculine is the active principle in the sense of, I don't know, just getting things done, for lack of a better term. And the feminine principle is that which nurtures, you know, and you can't have a functioning human being without both of them, to some degree. So
biologically,
no on one.
And
like psychologically. Like evolutionarily, I get the image of, like, I heard this on Facebook in a Chaos Magic group once. Somebody said it, and it's just never going to leave my mind. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, biologically speaking, the males are the disposable sex, right? They're tuned that way. That's why, like, oh, you scuffed my Pumas? I'm ready to fucking die right now over this.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's just how we're wired. Or, like, like the classic example of, I'll be back, fucking, why can't I think of names on the air? It's terrible.
Arnold Schwarzenegger
throwing away his whole life to, like, fuck his maid. Like, what the fuck is that shit?
Yeah.
Like, that's because males are, like, they are ready to literally die to protect. That's just how they're tuned. They're ready to throw themselves away in the moment for that thing. And then the women are more biologically programmed to survive the death of that male. And to, like, so they go out and hunt, you know, the deer and maybe die. I don't know, because they're hunting a tiger, not a deer. Maybe they die hunting the deer. It could happen. They eat the wrong potato. You don't know. And fucking, they bring back the deer and they're like, fuck, I'm tired and stupid. You know, and the women are like, I got this. I know what to do with the carcass. And so psychologically, it's like you have the male principle, which is like, it provides the base data. It provides the plan. It provides the information. And the feminine principle, like, organizes it into a thing, right? It makes it into a meal.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great example. And I like to use, because it's a simple but very nuanced and extremely useful symbol, you know, the yin and yang. The yin would be the feminine principle and the yang would be the masculine. I'm like 99.9% sure that.
Yeah. Yang and, hangs out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and you could also correlate that to the trees of life and death in Kabbalah.
I was going to ask you about that next. Awesome.
Yeah. So the alchemists focused on this idea, aside from their metallurgy and their chemistry experiments and whatnot. The idea was to refine and purify the psyche. And how you do that is by depolarizing in unifying your opposites. You know, what they would call the sacred alchemical marriage.
Dude, how do you do that? How do you practically do that? Like, let's just pause, because that seems like you've accomplished some of that, and part of your book is like expounding on that. So just as a sample, like, how do you start to reconcile those two things? Like, what's the best method?
Another great question. And I will start by saying that what I'm talking about is not enlightenment in the strictest sense. Like, I'm certainly not enlightened. I'm a very regular average person. And what you're looking for more is just, I don't know, like a bit more lucidity in your life. There's a difference, you know, enlightenment being like this paragon of like human ability to just, you know, navigate your way through life without any real hiccups. And lucidity is just being more capable. You know, it's not that you're going to be able to, you're always going to have, you know, every human's going to have their problems, but
you wouldn't be driven by them as much. You'd be more conscious of what those demons are. And so when they come up, basically
100%.
And so there's this, so that ties in with the notion that like the feminine or the dark is like bad, you know what I mean? And then the male is good. Right. And that's where that comes up. Right.
Yes, and this is another big crux, because that is how it's often framed in certain organized groups of thought. You know, like especially when you get into the Abrahamic religions and stuff like that. Not so much in the East, but and I think that's certainly a disservice. I don't agree with that, but this is how I interpret it in the long run, because
there is Lilith, right? We got Lilith going on.
Right. Right. And I think that, and man, what a fascinating archetype right there. But I think that the takeaway from that is the end goal being the sacred alchemical marriage, so to speak. Like, if you're looking at the tree of death and you're saying that that's the unconscious femininity, you know, obviously it's real easy to consider the fact that you're basically equating a femininity with demonology, and that's not the case, because the tree of death is the absence of the union. It's not the absence of the masculine, it's the absence of the union.
Okay, that's really interesting. I like that. Okay, keep going, man.
Yeah, because I mean, hell, I don't have any complaints about femininity. It's, you know, it's something that I look forward to in my life. But if you don't have the ability to reconcile that, like, you know, speaking from my perspective, I guess, if you don't have the ability to, conceptualize how you want to, you know, like have a good relationship, or you just be in tune with your emotions, because that's not an easy thing to be in tune with your emotions. And that causes dissonance. And that's essentially what the Lilith archetype represents. Now, granted, to some people, she's considered a goddess, and I don't dispute that, because I think that there's multiplicity to any archetype, especially when considering the fact that a lot of gods become demons once the cultures have been overtaken. So when Christians set the precedence over paganism, all the pagan deities become the demons of Christian theology, and so forth. And you can find that the world over throughout history.
Yeah.
So that's certainly the case with Lilith. And I will make that disclaimer, but I think that metaphorically, you know, there is some sympathy for the devil, because when you look into the alphabet of Ben-Sira is where she's first talked about, and Lilith, for anyone who doesn't know, is an esoteric tradition stemming from the Hebrew mysticism. Lilith is the first wife of Adam before Eve, and She becomes a demon because she runs away and just kind of like scorns God and Adam and says, you know, fuck all of this. I'm not interested in being a part of this. And that seems overtly demonic from a Christian point of view. And sure, archetypally, there are some, you know, we'll get into like how that correlates to the tree of death and sleep paralysis and whatnot. But there's also a little bit of sympathy to be had, like I said, because I mean, it's kind of the question we all have is like, why was I even made?
Why'd you create me this way?
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just here in the garden. I have to do what this guy says and what the creator says. And I don't really have a say in any of it. And I feel like a slave. I just feel like I'm being told what to do all the time. And I'm not interested in this. And I think that we can all relate to that. So,
and like, maybe that's the function of all this postmodern chaos is like, I believe maybe it's there, and like, that's why we're here, is to help dig to the bottom of this shit so we can, like, you know, get it out in the open. Like, what does this shit really mean? You know, because like, you also mentioned that, and this fascinated me, I had never considered this, that the path to heaven and the path to hell are both like pretty much like staircases right next to each other in Malkuth, the kingdom, like our material lives.
Right.
And it's Lilith who's like sits at that gateway, you know, like, right. I thought that was kind of cool.
And the to get into the anima and animus, tying that back in, sometimes these things, because you have to understand the grit of your personality, the things that lurk in the shadow, the things that you don't understand about yourself maybe aren't ready to understand, that's what Lilith represents. She's very much like Kali from Hindu mythology, and you know, this idea that it's a nurturing mother, but if you cross her, or especially if your enemies cross her, then she's going to be extremely wrathful. And if you're not paying homage to these parts of your psyche, then she's going to be pissed. You know, that's just how it goes. And if anything, I don't consider Lilith particularly demonic so much as I do consider her, you know, just a smart mother who teaches lessons when it needs to be taught. You know, like she'll smack your ass with the wooden spoon if that's what it takes, you know. And but you know, there are demons, you know, don't get me wrong, there are things that you shouldn't mess with as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know,
do you slay them? Do you trap them? Do you integrate them? Do you worship them? What do you do with them? That's maybe what are we supposed to do with the demons? You know, you put them in a triangle and be like, if I scream this name at you, you have to get me treasure and pussy, you know, like.
Right. Well, I think that the East has a much more nuanced interpretation of demonology than the West. And I really, really like the Buddhist notion. Like, for example, when you're in Bardo traveling through the states of consciousness and dimensions before you're reincarnated, you're said to go through levels of hell and experience demons as well as angels and levels of heaven as well. And and theoretically you could get stuck in that hell for as long as you let yourself. But the trick is, unlike the Abrahamic religions, that once you understand the underlying mechanisms, this is like the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. Once you understand like your right sight and right mind, and I can't remember the others, but then you uproot the underlying mechanisms of what's troubling you, and you can kind of see past it. And so that's how they say you get out of hell. And on that note, I find the Buddhist notion of the hungry ghost to be very, very, very interesting. And it's also a Taoist notion. It seems to stem mainly from China and Vietnam. And it's this idea of, like, I guess you could call it a demon, but it's certainly not a demon in the way that the West considers these things. It's almost something that you should have sympathy for, in a way. And in fact, that's how it goes about in the Eastern cultures, whereas a hungry ghost is like this this pot-bellied entity that is attracted, like we talked about before, with like sleep paralysis and like sharks sniffing blood in the water. They're attracted to the hedonistic human impulses that we have, whether it be addiction is probably the best overarching statement, but it doesn't have to be drugs. It could be anything. You know, just think about what compels you in life and how that can be a slippery slope. You know, the things that you have to use discipline on, you know, make sure you don't go overboard, whether it's drinking or anything else. Those are the things that hungry ghosts are attached to.
And like the people who can't stop, you know, like they're feeding something. This notion that like you could just drink and drink and not feel anything, and it's like the ghost that's right. My mom studied this stuff, and she would tell me about it as a kid, and she's like, yeah, some people are like hungry ghosts, you know, like hungry ghosts wow. are like these entities with these tiny mouths, and they're constantly hungry, and no matter what, they can't get enough food, and they're always hungry, and they just keep they want more and more and more, but it's never enough, you know.
Yes, yes.
Back to following your bliss, you know.
Right, agreed. Yeah, and like I said, these things in their traditional context are not demonic. They're not nefarious. They're things that only like they're in pain and suffering. And I think that some of the traditions consider them to be souls of people who have been like they haven't received you know the proper amount of rest or resolution in the afterlife. I don't necessarily go that far, but I think that these mechanisms, these hungry ghost mechanisms, are certainly evident in neurophenomenology. You know, the inertia behind our habits and these things.
Inertia, you really can't deny that. The cliff off with inertia, but before we jump into that, now that you bring it up, man, the Bardotho doll definitely does say those wrathful and beneficent deities spring out of the brain. They do
right,
say that.
Right.
They definitely yeah. do say that. And so in the book, you equate that concept of inertia, the bad habits, the bad things that we do, that ultimately, if you're thinking of a rocket, it's like drag. It's like shit that's making your mission not get to its complete state. Something that can fuck your entire mission. And I've also heard the cliff off related to like, why would you want to fuck with that? It's like a clogged toilet. I've had a really hard time penetrating those mysteries myself. Because I got really into Kabbalah and I liked it because, like, oh, everything in the universe sits in these 10 spheres. And then here comes along this, like, it's like, oh, but also there's these other 10 spheres. And it's like, no, fuck you. You know, it's like, right. They're already nested inside of each other. Why do we need this other thing now? Like, so I really like that concept that the cliff off might be like these shells, because that's what it means, right? Shells. They're right. around the, you know, the sephira or whatever. They're these accretions, and like, I don't know, I guess I'm just lusting after mental symmetry or some shit. But my point is like, what the fuck is the cliff off, man? Like, and like, what the hell are those things? Where do they exist? Like what the fuck, bro? Help me out.
Right. Yeah, no problem. Well, essentially, the idea of something like a hungry ghost or any entity, but especially a hungry ghost, because that's a great example, clinging to your the habits that have inertia in your life, those would be what I call like the phantom limbs of the psyche. Those are the things that you can feel the more you probe at them, but they're not exactly tangible in the strictest sense. I mean, they certainly are when you look into these things like neurobiology and whatnot, but it's not really on the nose. You gotta dig a little bit to understand what you're looking at. And
can I give an example to like give it some body?
Absolutely.
All right. So me and my friend, we're sitting there and we're like accounting stuff in our life. We're like, you know, we don't make a lot of money, but like everything in our life is kind of okay right now. You know, we got some problems, but like, why is this overwhelming feeling like the other shoe is going to drop at any moment? Like, why can't we just be happy with where we are? Like, why are we waiting for some bad shit to happen? That sounds – is that like what you're talking about, the phantom limb? Like this thing that you can feel but you don't know what, and it's like
– Absolutely. Yeah, because I can relate to that feeling 100%. And those are the Clyphoth shells, essentially. That's how I see it. Because, you know, Dante, when he was writing the Divine Comedy, was clearly very interested in what the Kabbalists were saying. There's clearly direct correlations between Dante's A Paradise, Purgatory, and Inferno. And that was, I'd been looking into the Clyphoth for some time, and that was something that helped it all really click in my brain. And granted, I think that the Christian interpretation of heaven and hell in the strict sense, obviously not quite where I'm going with this, but I find a lot of use. I deeply appreciate Christian symbolism. I was raised Christian technically, although I don't really subscribe to that anymore. I don't really know what I subscribe to. I'm just an esotericist, really. But see, the way I look at something like heaven and hell or the trees of life and death are – because I find those terms to be pretty synonymous. And I think that implies your life, what you're living currently. You know, we've all lived through heaven and hell and probably a little bit of purgatory too. So I don't really think that many people could really deny that when they start to think about it. And that makes so much more sense than these ephemeral places that you might go to. Now, I don't discount the fact that the soul might travel to other places. And hell, it probably does. But I think that religion oftentimes, any religion, puts too much emphasis on this idea of like waiting to go to these different places. And it's not really about waiting. You know, these places are archetypally transposed.
Active. They're like active, yeah, in the moment.
100%. You know, the example you gave, there are a lot of different ways that we could go about explaining this. But the example you gave about just like that overbearing cloud above you that just kind of seemed to, dampen like any sense of peace you might have in the moment, or at least hold you back from as much peace as you could be getting. Like that, in essence, is the Clyphoth. It's that notion where you can feel that things could be better, but you don't know how to make them better. Like that, in essence, is what the Kabbalists were stabbing at. And I also find the Clyphoth very interesting because it's still a work in progress, in essence. It hasn't nearly been around as long as the Tree of Life. Yeah, yeah. I mean, technically speaking, I guess you could say it's been around as long as the Tree of Life has, because as soon as you start talking about ideals, you open up the gate to, you know, the opposite of ideals, like rock bottom, worst case.
Yeah, yeah. See, that makes some sense. And so they're like, okay, well, now that would make sense that there's this other thing that we can map, basically.
right, like yin and yang, yeah. So as soon as people start developing more and more the systematizing of the Tree of Life and categorization and whatnot, they inevitably come across these things that, you know, the inversions of it. And because I mean, hell, that's how black magic, as far as history is concerned, has developed, is people try and create ways to live better lives, and then other people look at it and say, I could create a better life, but what if I cut out helping out everybody else? You know, I just get mine. The Clyphoth, essentially, I guess if you want a general terminology of it, is, yeah. Well, I don't know. You can't really give a basic terminology of it because it's so specific with each Clyphoth point. But I think that the crux of it is this idea of not knowing what's real and what's not. Like, that is where things get really dicey. And not just like real life. Like, obviously, you know what's physical and what isn't. You know, there's a chair in front of you. We're not talking about that, but like your emotional complexes and, yeah, who am I? Where do I fit into this? When it's good and healthy to question those things, but when you have no idea, and like in my case in the past, when you've given up on not only trying to find those answers, but you've given up on thinking that there are any answers. That's where these this Clyfoth allegory like really sinks its teeth in, because it's the, I don't know, the further you can feel yourself away from a sense of peace, the closer you know that you are to something that's keeping you from it. And
like it's occluding the light somehow. It's occluding right. the good juicy goodness you're looking for.
Right. And let's tie this together a little bit. Essentially these things are the I consider the Clyfoth to be the lessons that your sacred mother is teaching you when things get to rock bottom. And I think it's really healthy to, I use the Clyfoth as a diagnostic tactic. I don't sit down and perform meditation or like hypnotic like rituals or anything like that with the Clyfoth. I don't recommend that. I think that that's a really slippery slope, although any listeners out there, you might have a useful basis for it, but I don't see any practical application outside of the Clyfoth other than diagnosis to help you understand the Tree of Life more, or just straight black magic. And I'm obviously not an advocate of black magic. I think, I think that people like LaVey and Crowley were brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but they were only out to get theirs. They weren't really interested in anybody else, and they openly admitted that. And I think that that was both of their downfalls. I think that that's the downfall of any quote black magician. Granted, that's a little bit of a throwaway term, but if you're a black magician, you're not necessarily sacrificing people or you're not necessarily the most horrific person on the planet per se, but you
Hermes,
are a person that doesn't care about anybody else.
Hermes said something to you that was very Thelemic, I thought, which caught my attention.
But what is that?
He was like, if you're going to do some vice, do it to me, do it to the sacred. And that that has some alchemical effect on the vice and on the thing you're doing. And man, that resonated so fucking hard with what Nuit says in the first Book of the Law.
It's been a hot minute since I've read the Book of the Law, so I don't remember the exact the piece that you're talking about, but I certainly know, I feel where you're going with that. And
it's like to take strange drugs and, dance under the stars, and it won't hurt you as long as you're doing it to me. And the idea is like you should. It's okay to indulge, but don't be animal about it. And in fact, that's part of the art of indulgence, is indulging in a way that elevates the experience rather than lowers you. And that it's actually sacred and holy. It's a sacred and holy experience, which is what Hermes told you. I thought that was fucking fascinating. like, fuck, man, because I really struggled with a lot of this light, dark stuff. And that's why I'm so obsessed with it, why I just ask obnoxious questions about it. I said I would come back and talk shit about the New Age, and here it is. Like, when I first got into some of this shit, like magic, I didn't really have anyone to talk to, because I was getting away from like some weird fucking I got introduced into like a group. I almost got MK Ultra'd, but I didn't. We won't get into that. Okay. So I discovered like, oh shit, some of this shit is real. How do I use it? And I was just like out in the open waters. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any guidance. All I had was like Barnes and Noble books, which are whatever. And I remember asking a Wiccan, I think she was a Wiccan. I was like, okay, so according to the law of attraction, what if I want to write some H.P. Lovecraft shit? What if I want to write some major horror shit? Am I going to attract that into my life? And she was like, yeah, that's a possibility. And I like froze. And I wish I had somehow found a way to get over that. Like that's also Clyfothic. It's like, I didn't know what to do. So I stopped being creative kind of. And I spent like maybe 10 fucking years exploring this shit, trying to find some objective meaning, some objective moral meaning to any of this magic stuff. And I'll be honest, man, I feel like the Book of the Law has helped me a little bit, because the New Age thing is kind of bullshit. Like I think in the Book of the Law, you're sort of encouraged to like go towards those things that are dark
and like get your hands dirty and really like understand them and know why. Like, you have to integrate that part of yourself that's attracted to that thing, whatever it is, you know, for good or for bad.
You know, Crowley is such an enigmatic character because I find the generally speaking, the first half of his like career, quote unquote, to be very insightful, and I don't know, his intentions seem to be more on point. And I'm not necessarily demonizing him or anything. I'm not an expert on Crowley's personal life, but I've heard enough and read enough to it seems like he really went off the deep end. And so I think that I think that there is plenty of value in Crowley's work, and I don't think that anyone should be discouraged from considering what he has to say. But I don't know. I guess if anything, he should be the end of his life. The way I look at it is, it should be considered a little bit of a cautionary tale, because I think he got a little too comfortable with some of these things, and that they had their way with him a little bit. He died destitute, essentially, and in poor health. Like, he didn't have much to speak of at all.
It depends who you talk to.
Fair enough. Yeah. As it usually is with people like Aleister Crowley.
When I was researching Crowley, you got like, it was usually two things. It was like either he's a saint or he's Satan himself. It was like, you know, and then some was in the middle, but it was like secretly leaning very hard towards he's a saint. You know what I mean? It was like,
yeah.
And like, he did some bad shit in his life. You know what I mean? Here's the thing. He got the Book of the Law in like 1904. But that was like the same time, fucking around the same time, it was a little earlier, that Carl Jung was like, he was compiling his black book into the red book, right?
Right.
And on the very first page of that red book is a big D, right? And on the D, you see all the zodiac, right? And the sun is moving into Aquarius.
Mm.
So you can see the sun is moving backwards through the zodiac, and that it's moving into Aquarius, and like, that's that great, that great year you were talking about. Well, I think the great year is it moves through all the signs. This is just, it's moving to the next sign. So like, beyond Crowley, there's this idea of the age of Aquarius. So like, if you just toss the age of Horus and all that shit out, you still got the age of Aquarius with Jung, and essentially a very similar prophecy that there'd be this age of war, which there fucking was and maybe still is, followed by an age of magic, which is like, here you are writing the fucking dive manual, you know, the age of magic where we're trying to figure it out, followed by, you know, an age of religion, he thought, where I guess essentially we'd start to figure out some of this shit. Like, I don't know. Are there new laws for this new age? Is there were they tapped into some idea that was bigger than them and they just put their own flavor on it? Like, I kind of think so. Like, Hermes is like, dude, just smoke the weed, but smoke it to me, man. Like,
right.
Like, that's, like, life is about like living it. It's not about like avoiding it necessarily. But you do bring that up in the book too, how like the Buddhist, the monk, you know, like seeks out the temple, and like the junkie just has to be next to the dumpster. But they're both doing the same thing, sort of, where they're, I don't know, they're dropping out of the experience in some way.
Yeah, 100%. And for me, to elaborate for the listener and even you guys a little bit, I have an autoimmune disease. It's only eczema, but it's pretty bad, and it's enough to where I have plenty of stomach issues and skin issues as well, and those things will flare up with stress and diet.
Eczema
or a complication.
Can cause stomach issues?
Yeah, it stems from the gut bacteria. So
shut up, no way, dude. It makes me, dude. Maybe that was where my problem came from so many years ago. Oh my god, you might have solved a riddle. I had no idea. Anyway, so yeah, it's an autoimmune thing,
right? And cannabis has always helped me with that ever since I found it when I was like 16, going on 17. And
dude, me too. When I was 21, like, I had these gnarly stomach problems. I lost all this weight. I was super sick. And just one day I had this weird feeling like, well, I'm going to go get a weed card. Fuck it. I've run out of ideas. I was on Prilosec all the time. And like, it helped. Like, my stomach just could work better.
I could totally relate to that. Yeah. And for anyone having problems like that, you know, weed is not a cop out. It will legitimately help. And owe such a large quality of my life to cannabis. Not so much anymore. I still love it. I still partake. But there was a time in my life when I was younger going through some of the contents, hell, all the contents in the book, if I'm being perfectly honest, where sometimes, you know, cannabis was the only thing that got me through it. You know, sometimes you just need a little bit of a pick-me-up and nothing else is picking you up. And you know that you can go pack a bowl and feel at least a little bit better.
Yeah.
And you'll at least cut down on some of the potential physical symptoms that are helping muck up your mental space. And that's what I found for me a lot. And so anyway, point being, so I have this like kind of like love-hate relationship with cannabis, I guess, where it helps me so much, but I also find it to be a crutch in some ways. You know, sometimes there's a like in the past, especially, not so much anymore because I've kind of learned to fine tune a little bit. But there'd be times when my stomach would be killing me and I didn't want to go spend money on weed, but I didn't know what else to do, honestly. You know, I just wanted a little bit of relief, like serious, serious
pain. Dude, painful can I give you what aches. Worked for me?
Yeah.
Dude, I suffered with the shit. I lost so much weight. I went from being kind of like a chubby person to being like, oh, this guy has cancer. Like, I went from kind of fat to like pretty damn skinny, right? And I found a picture somewhere of my old ID, and I fucking have it on my computer somewhere. Dude, like, when I started smoking, like, it helped, but the thing that helped without weed, it's like this $3 bottle of... It comes from Santa Barbara. It's apple cider vinegar. Bragg's apple cider vinegar. Ooh. Do not fuck with it unless it's Bragg's.
Okay.
Because it's going to lead to our next topic. It has what's called the mother in it. And this is like this accumulated like bacterial goop. And you shake it up and it's got the mother in it. And you drink it and it's like drinking. It tastes like vomit. So you got to mix it with water. I've literally seen my friends puke when they drink it. It's a good time, right? So
yeah.
So what you do is you just put like a teaspoon of it in a glass of water and you get past the fact that it tastes like drinking diluted puke. And dude, I wish I discovered this shit right away. It fucking is a miracle. It works really fast. If you have an ulcer, maybe even a hangover, and even though you're drinking acid, it does something where it works, dude. If you haven't tried it, just try it. If it doesn't work, don't do it. And do it the way I said. Don't drink a shot of it. It's bad for you. It's bad for your teeth, and you will definitely throw up. You need to take 2 teaspoons and put it in like a big old glass of water. 2 teaspoons. Maybe a tablespoon. Put it in a glass of water. You'll feel better. And if you're not, it costs you $3.
Right on. Yeah, I'm going to have to try that as well. I did find some use in aloe vera juice and some other things. Aloe vera juice is pretty good, but apple cider vinegar is so versatile. It's impressive. I've heard of its use in other things as well. But great aside, but to drive that point, that original point home a little bit, the reason that how I interpret it, that Hermes told me, you know, like, if you're going to keep smoking weed, you need to do it while you're writing. You know, you need to apply it to something productive, because I was at a point in my life where I wasn't sure how to – well, I could really relate to an addict because I wasn't exactly experiencing physical symptoms, like nothing like being dope sick or being an alcoholic. But because I had – unrelated symptoms that would flare up without the cannabis, it felt strangely similar.
Oh, dude, I get night sweats like no one's business.
Right, right. I feel you. So,
like if I go on a plane somewhere and I just don't bring any weed, like night 2 or 3, I will wake up like the bed is like drenched. It's like I had a fever. Like the entire bed is completely soaked. Like.
Yeah, and some people would say that, like, oh, you need to stop. That's clearly the cannabis. And like, no, actually, the cannabinoids have such a all-encompassing utility in our bodies itself.
It like, affects it, a it, lot.
It,
yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It there's you have cannabinoid receptors in your gut and in your brain. Like it's literally. I've heard scientists explain cannabinoids as oil to the body, like oil is to a car or something.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's if you're having any hiccups in your body, like you just, you know, pump it full of a little bit of cannabis, oil or smoke or whatever, and it's going to help smooth those things out. That's just the nature of it. So
I heard back in the day, like the cows and the shit we were eating, the animals we were eating were grazing on it, and the milk we were drinking was infused with it. So it's like at some point we just cut it out of our diet entirely, and it's like it might be a nutrient that's necessary.
Oh, yeah. Oh, basically. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I would agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, it works. For the sun, yeah, at least for me, like the way you described it is oil. Like, oh yeah, man. Like, it's like, oh, this was stopped and not working, and now it is. Like,
right. Yeah, so for anybody, you know, whatever thing you have, even if it's something rough, man, like, if you're trying to quit an addictive habit, you know, like even like heroin or something, in my experience and from what I've studied and researched, the best way to go about beginning that is to apply it to something useful, you know, because you're going to have to kick that habit eventually. And like people quit smoking cigarettes all the time and it'll go back to it. You know, nicotine is only like a 3-day dependency, but there's that inertia behind it. And, you have to replace it with something. You have to, like, that inertia is not going to go away. So it has to almost be like transposed onto something else. Once you transpose it onto something, like, I don't know, let's just give an example. Like, if you're going to smoke a cigarette after, you know, you make a point, like after you get off of work or something, that cigarette after you get off of work, you go and run a mile afterwards, you're going to be breathing heavy. You're going to be probably regretting the run overall, but it's going to remind you the reasons that you should stop smoking. And also it's going to start building habits, to kind of supplant that smoking. And so even if, you know, it's like the same thing as someone eating a donut after they go to the gym, you know, like a reward type thing. Like, yeah, there's something to be said about that. And that's a slippery slope because you have to kick that. It's like training wheels. You got to take the training wheels off eventually. But
I mean,
there's
no
shame in using
it,
training wheels.
It's like not being animal about it and just like finding the highest way to indulge in it in a way.
Right.
And then
so, I mean, we're all humans. We're going to indulge. And if you don't think that you indulge, then you're lying to yourself or you're neurotic as hell. Because the people who don't indulge in some ways, I don't trust them. You know, if you're completely sober, straight laced, you know, just average Joe do-gooder, you're probably a serial killer as far as I'm concerned. Straight laced, you know,
like you're a fucking reptile.
you're just like a
mask with like a fucking Tom Hanks demon underneath, fucking ready to fucking unleash.
Right. Straight up. So. To tie that back in with the things we were talking about previously, I think that there are certain things that, you know, like you want to say like demonological entities. So there are certain things that you need to kick. There are certain things that are parasitic, that are clinging to you, that have no real purpose or utility in your life. And they're just going to suck your life force out of you. But, yeah, but there are other things that, that are going to help you, angelic. That's obviously a given. And then there are other things more that are, just part of life, man. Like
otherworldly, maybe.
Right. You leave food out on the ground, for days on end. You don't pick it up. There's going to be ants there eating it up and bringing it back. Like, is that the ant's fault for coming into your house? Like, you left the food on the ground. That's like a law of nature, essentially. Something was going to come and get it. And it's not evil. It's just opportunist. And that's what I consider like these hungry ghosts and stuff. And that's what I think a lot of addiction is. You know, something like rape and murder and these other things, those would be demonic. But something like addiction where you're like you're harming yourself, as a best example, that's not something that's evil per se, but it's certainly not helpful. Certainly not helpful. So I think that people need to have a very nuanced perspective when dealing with these things, because if you throw the baby out with the bathwater, if you only consider demons and angels, then you're gonna lose a lot of the middle ground, and you end up alienating parts of your psyche, because that's what these things are. The phantom limbs, these things are reflecting parts of you that already exist, whether these archetypes are played, and archetypes are just attracted to whatever Hertz wave that your brain is pulling out or putting out. And yeah, so if you look at something like, let's say, the hungry ghost, like your addiction, if you're struggling with addiction, you just think like, this is, you know, it's like scorning the inner child inside of you. You need to nurture these things. You can't disassociate yourself from these things. Like, especially with addiction, oftentimes we're trying to mask the things that, you know, are painful and hard to deal with. And you know, especially, it's a very common thread in our culture where you're supposed to, I don't know, just like toss all that out, you know.
If
there's a bad habit, you toss out everything associated with it. But what I'm suggesting is that you open that up. You don't necessarily celebrate it or deify it or glorify it, but you have sympathy for it. You understand that, you know, there's certain times where evil is a factor, but in most cases, I think that evil is a fairly strong outlier. I don't think that's happening all the time. I think that those are special cases. You know, like, think of serial killers. We don't have serial killers running around all the time. They're a little few and far between. And
but what about like capitalism, man?
Fair enough.
Like, our cell phones are made of like slave children and stuff. That kind of thing.
That those are great points, and that's a damn good question. Something that I couldn't definitively answer, but I think that there are, you know, varying levels of negligence that add up to evil. Like, and that's another reason why I give archetypes the credit that they deserve, is because sometimes people aren't necessarily evil, but what they're doing is just demonstrable.
Right. And like, even like what evil is in general, like, people disagree on its nature and how it works. And it's like, anytime you go and try and understand this shit, it is naturally confusing. And in Star Wars, right, it's like, oh, the dark side, it clouds you. You know, it definitely does. Yeah. Like, there's some knowledge to that. Speaking of things that, like, we maybe can't understand. Dude, what the fuck? UFOs. Okay? Just to wrap up the show. This is probably our longest show we've ever done, but I think to wrap it up, we got to talk a little bit about your cryptid experiences. And we got to talk about, what the fuck are those things, man? Like, what? Like, okay, so you talk about in your book, and this is probably one of my favorite parts is, how do you pronounce it? You sort of created like almost like a Discordian lodge, not really Discordian, but you created like your own lodge with your friends where you were exploring the mysteries by going on like vision quests, and you talk about going into the woods behind your house. I would usually explore the community college. That was my woods, but I think the actual woods is where you're gonna run into some. Like, you guys said you saw, like, you know, I'm sure every now and then you would see, like, oh, is that a shadow? But you guys said every now and then you would witness something that was like, what the fuck? And my favorite thing that you mentioned was, like, you guys were laying on the ground and you saw a bunch of stars moving around. And, the stars were fucking moving, you said.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few experiences. So, when, I don't know, like, 18 to 20, and maybe going into, like, almost 21, I lived at this place on a Beaujolais Road. Beaujolais is some sort of wine.
I might have said that correctly, Beaujolais, in my head. But no, I love the name Beaujolais. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great word. Yeah, and I lived with some great uncles of mine. Great in like the technical term, they were great people, but, you know, they're great uncles, technically speaking. And they didn't really care what I did, as long as it wasn't like highly addictive, as long as I wasn't shooting up down there and being super loud. So if we were having some mushrooms or whatever, they didn't really care. And and I was paying rent anyway, so they weren't going to say too much. So I just have a bunch of friends come over, and we'd have in-depth conversations about whatever struck our fancy. And more often than not, it was esotericism. And that's one of the reasons I had to put this chapter in the book is I'm the first to admit that I probably wouldn't have written this book as young as I did, being only 24. If not for my friends, honestly, like I have been blessed to have some really good friends that I grew up with who somehow through sheer luck, as far as I can see it, were, you know, into the same things I was and were willing to have extensive conversations and go read books about it. And I think I took it a little further than anybody else did, but I still can have those conversations with the same friends.
Oh, there's always got to be, you know, there's always got to be one at least in the group that'll do that. And like having friends like that, that'll get into that with you. That's a real blessing, you know, totally.
Sure. Yeah. And so we, being adventurous and young, we're all guys just hanging out. None of us had girlfriends really at the time. You know, we're all young trying to figure ourselves out. So when you're being adventurous, and especially the fact that we were in Alaska, a lot of dreary, dark coldness. So what the hell else are you going to do except have good conversation with friends and maybe take some drugs, specifically psychedelics. So
yee.
Yeah, we took, you know, plenty of mushrooms and acid. We never smoked any DMT, but there was some salvia in the mix sometimes.
Can I interject one little factoid that
like, absolutely.
So, dude, when I got into this psychedelia stuff, I read about the sensory deprivation experiments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you brought this up on the fucking Abracast. You were like, yeah, you know, what happens? You just take LSD and you go into your psychic memory and you just emerge like a fucking crazy ape.
Like, right.
They fucking lied to us, bro. They lied. They told us they took LSD because that was the popular thing at the time and it would get them more attention and funding. You know what they were taking?
What?
Ketamine.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So just to, like, I want to interject that like I probably wasted many years of my life because they fucking lied to me about that.
Yeah, super curious. Yeah, you know, the psychedelic thing, we'll definitely get into the cryptids for any listeners. We're building up to that, so don't feel like
psychedelics are good. That's a good build. Yeah. Oh my god.
It's necessary to a certain degree because more often than not, the psychedelics are where most people have cryptid type encounters or supernatural type encounters. And there's this whole debate that's becoming more and more mainstream about whether or not these things like are real or, you know, like whether your hallucinations are real on a different level.
Oh, I love this shit, dude. I fucking love this shit.
Yeah. And I think that in the same way that dreams are, these hallucinations are very real. This just not literally real.
Yeah.
But the fact that something is not literally real does not mean that there's no realness to it. Not by a long shot. So I think that, you know, like the same thing with shadow people. Like as far as science is concerned, these things are hallucinations, but these hallucinations are indicative of biological underpinnings, you know, the trauma that you're, and even if someone is not like in the grips of PTSD or something, you know, some people will experience something like sleep paralysis just as remnants because you can't get rid of that neurology. You have to redirect it in some way. And so psychedelics are great for that, but they're a very double-edged sword because you don't know what you're opening up. You know, if you're not disciplined and you don't understand what you're doing, you could fall straight down the rabbit hole and God knows what you'll see. But then again, those are some of the best trips. You know, like what we're talking about. You know, follow your blisters, not your bliss. You know, the bliss should be the end game, but you should be looking for your blisters right out the gate. And that's what my friends and I, you know, we would take psychedelics and we would go walk in the woods behind my house, which was a pretty dense wilderness. And
I thought it was so cool that it was like, oh, there's no bugs or snakes or like – there was something like, as a Southern California kid, we don't have like a lot of bugs. Like sometimes you do, like if you go in Ojai, you'll just get these crazy welts like from bugs eating you. But we kind of get it, like we don't get covered in bugs. It's not like the South. But the way you described your wilderness was like you were not going to get eaten by anything. You could actually have a cool psychedelic like romp and not get ticks, you know?
Right. Yeah, you don't have to worry about a single thing. We'd go out in the winter usually, and you didn't have to worry about bears or moose hardly. You know, like everything is either tucked away, minding its own business because it's a cold and harsh environment, or it's straight up hibernating. So yeah, you could really just run around in the woods and just kind of let your mind take hold. And we saw things on those trips. And I'll also say that after I talk about the psychedelic experiences, there were some experiences we had sober, aside from, like, you know, maybe smoking a bowl and a little bit of, you know, some beers kicked back. But,
right.
You know, while we were on the psychedelics, man, we saw a plethora of the physical nature of them was so shocking. Like, not so much. It wasn't
what
like
was it that
there
you
were
saw?
Marks
What was
left.
It that you saw?
Right, that's it. That's
no, no,
a good
what,
thing to bring up.
No, what was it that you saw? You saw, because I think that it broke up a bit when you said what you saw. It was like you saw lights, or
yeah, no, that's a good point, because I didn't really articulate what exactly I saw, so I should. And okay. There was a few different things. Like, we saw UFOs several times. Other friends hallucinated spirit animals. Like, one was being chased by a grizzly bear that was telling him, like, how he was going to die in the future. And,
oh my God, that's so scary.
Yeah, some friends were talking to trees who were like deities and all sorts of stuff. And we saw figures in the woods. Like, there's friends of mine who said that they were communicating with something flying, like, overhead before, like, some sort of angel or demon, who knows, you know. And these are psychedelics, so you take it with a grain of salt, but the fact of the matter is these things happened to us, whether or not they were physical, and they had ramifications in the way we viewed our lives and the way we lived our lives. So
that's what's important, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and that's what Jung himself would say, is that, you know, that's why he was so fascinated with religion and folklore, is set aside whether or not these things are, like, literally real, quote unquote. Let's look at how they affect humans as a whole. And when you do that, you see how dramatically they affect us all, whether it's folklore or religion. And once you take that into account, you can't walk away with anything, with any notion other than these have relevance to the human condition. Regardless of their how physical they are. So even if you're taking a psychedelic, those things are very, very they're very indicative of your human experience as a whole. Now, the things that we saw while we were more or less sober were the UFOs, and hell, I saw one. I don't know what these things are. They're still flying around in Alaska. They're still out there, man. And I don't know if it's government craft, because we live next to a really large Air Force base. So it could very well be that. I don't know, man. But I've never seen anything like that. There's nothing on record like those things. They were like – there were triangles, and they had red, white, and blue light, similar to a commercial plane. But I saw this shit sober. I'll reiterate one more time: flying, like, this one specific occasion I'm thinking of, flying over my roof, like, dude, like, maybe not even 100 feet in the air. It was right,
so cool, it was
right there. Yeah, I'll never forget it. And I remember thinking
so
to
jelly.
Myself. It was wild, man. I remember thinking to myself, this has got to be a plane. Like, let me just, like, relax my eyes for a second, and I'm sure that I'll find some detail where I'm like, oh, you're an idiot. It's obviously what this is. And it just never happened. I watched it for, like, a good 30 seconds, man, because I don't go through all this detail in the book. So I'll tell you a fun little story to wrap
yeah,
this
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
I was sitting down outside. I honestly, I can't. I think in the book, I described this as seeing with friends, because there was an occasion. There were a few occasions where I saw UFOs with friends, and like I said, I minced some of it together in the book just to not bore people with unnecessary details. So here's the elaboration of my story a little bit. I was alone And I was sitting outside, and we had already seen some UFOs, me and my friends, and I was just sitting outside literally thinking about it, like wondering, you know, and I'm staring out into the woods where we go for our psychedelic trips from my porch, and there's a fence, a wooden fence in my line of sight, separating me from the woods, and there's also a grocery store on the other, like deep on the other side of the woods. And so every once in a while you can see street lights. Now I saw a light and I thought I was looking at a street light, like, to the parking lot. And so I kind of like slink down in my seat so that the fence blocks the light.
Yeah.
But it didn't block the light. And so, and I was like, I know it should from my angle. So I stood up. And I see that there's this light, this giant white orb in the sky coming right for me. I swear to God. Oh, my God. Yeah, and I have this moment in my head where, like, oh, my God, what's happening? Like, wait, is this really happening? I don't. You know, do I go and run and grab a camera? I didn't have a phone or anything on me. And I said, no, I'm not going to do any of that because half the time it doesn't seem like those pictures really, really wash anyway. So I'm just in this for the experience. I just want to see what I can see. And so the thing comes closer, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, how close is this thing going to get? Like, is it really just going to come right for me? And it sure as hell did. And it flew over my roof, and it was very slow too. I don't know how fast, like maybe the speed of like a bicycle or something.
And you
know,
it was moving like smooth, like
it was lurking, and it was completely silent.
Okay,
completely
silent.
Yeah. So it was flying over rooftops without a sound. And this was like 2 a.m. too, pitch black. So, and I got the underbelly shot of it. I got the underbelly, and I watched it as it flew over my roof. I ran out off my porch to the front of the street in front of my house, and continued to watch. I ran down the street following it, and eventually it disappeared over a mountain range that wasn't far from my house. And
wow.
Actually, yeah, that's the Chugach Mountain Range for any ufologists interested. And whenever I've seen a UFO in Alaska, it's always disappeared behind the Chugach Mountain Range. I don't know what the hell that means, but
they talk about like the hippie New Agers, man. They say that Mount Shasta is like an intergalactic gateway. So maybe that one is too, that mountain. Maybe it's like a gateway.
Who knows, man? There's been archetypal significance impressed on the idea of the mountain. Like even especially in the East, if I remember correctly, where they considered them like spiritual antennas of like energy, like etheric energy. And that's supposedly what the pyramids are as well.
Oh,
these massive electromagnetic conductors.
The holy mountain. So,
yeah.
We must rub its secrets, the holy mountain.
But yeah, I guess if everything in the material universe is an accretion of spirit, then a mountain would be like an accumulation of energy. Like, you know, what if it's got like crystals, you know, creating a matrix of consciousness around it? Because is it the gnomes, man? You got to be careful. The gnomes will kidnap you. and it makes me wonder, like, I'll probably say this because, like, if you're a podcast, you kind of have a position on these things. And this is for someone who's never seen or experienced anything. I saw a UFO in a glass of water once when I was, fungus. Anyway, I saw a whole galaxy in a glass of water once when I was eating fungus.
Wow.
And what was crazy is I looked everywhere else in the room and everything else was totally normal. So, like, that was weird. And then I went back to the glass of water and it was like, I saw like what looked like metal that was inner flipping out of itself in a cloud. And I knew that was like a ship and it was very beautiful. And I don't know what these fucking things mean. Like Terrence McKenna says, they're a symbol of like the unknown and the unconscious. And, you know, I think it's here's what I think they are. I think that they're fairies, dude. I think they're fairies. I think they're natural inhabitants of the imaginal world that somehow can impress themselves into the physical world somehow in some cases, or they slip in and slip out. But that's just a theory. I don't know for sure.
Right. Yeah, man. I totally agree with that sentiment. And I think that cryptids, you could pretty much insert that, like this whole supernatural, whether it's Hell the Mothman or I think that these things have so much to do with everything we've talked about in this podcast. And I think that they operate in the same ways. I think that these things, they certainly, you know, and this is getting really theoretical, which I'm happy to do, but I think that probably most of these things, if not all of them, stem from the mind, but that doesn't mean that they are not real in the strictest sense. And I think that there's also a possibility that these things can become physical, like a priest experiencing stigmata. That there are enough situations to at least have even like a skeptical person consider the fact that you can create physical manifestation of things with your mind if you're in this pretty specific states of mind, like altered states of consciousness,
and like
especially like fear,
dissociative personality disorder. Different alters can have different scars that'll disappear when another alter comes in and stuff like that. I've heard that. I don't know.
Hey, I forgot about that. That I've read that too. I totally forgot, and that's a great damn example. Yeah, that's wild stuff, man. So I think that there's you know, like you talking about seeing like a universe and a UFO and a glass of water, like some people would scoff at that, but I think that that's highly relevant. And you know, it's got just as much use as a dream, which it is a lot of use as far as I'm concerned. You know, these things are just as important as memories and your favorite artwork. You know, they're part. It's that thing where you're talking about earlier. One of the tenets that is appreciable about New Age is like follow your excitement, follow your intuition, because that's reality essentially.
Yeah, and I really like that. That's our connection to things is like how we grow bigger and expand, like on a higher level. And like, even if we're led to like somewhere bad, we should be still reaching towards something good, you know?
Yeah, 100%, man. Well, I got to work in the morning, so I should probably let you go for now. But hey, man, this was a great conversation. And please, like, I'm happy to come back and have more of these conversations anytime. Consider me as part of your network, man. Like, I'm.
Thank you. Absolutely, man. This has been a great talk. I loved reading your book. Man, that feeling when like you're around somebody and like time stops, you know what I mean? And you just feel like I love. Yeah, check out the book if you wanna hit on some crazy emotions and learn some crazy ass shit, because it's called The Fucking Dive Manual by Anthony Tyler. Check it out. It's on Amazon. It doesn't even cost that much money. Your broke ass, like, which is probably you know, less broke than my ass, can afford it. If I can afford it, you can. So get on Amazon and check it out, man. If this talk was fascinating and you have any interest in the occult or the esoteric or dreams, please check it out. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mr. Anthony Tyler.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and thank you for taking the time to read the book. I'm glad that you did so, and I'm glad that you liked it and got something out of it. So that means a lot to me. You know, I put myself in a position to make a little bit of money. You know, obviously the book is for sale, but ultimately I just really wanted to – I put a lot of time, blood, sweat, and tears into this book just so I could have conversations like this, you know, get in touch with people who are interested and want similar food for thought. So I'm not trying to get too cheesy, but I really do appreciate that you got something out of it. And that's really cool, man. So thank you. Because that was every intention I had behind this thing.
And thank you for reaching out to me, man. That's really cool. Like, it's cool that you found us and you're like, hey, it'd be cool, like, come on the show. And, you know, thank you for that, man. It's great to have somebody who's like written a book that's like gone through some shit, and then I can talk to them about some of this stuff, because that's how we learn and grow, and like that's how this network of knowledge expands. You know, this is what we can't really do on social media. This is what we have to do in this realm. And it's you writing books, it's us doing podcasts, and thank you again, man. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Blessings to you both and all the listeners, and I look forward to our next conversation, man. Take care.
Absolutely, me too. Eat carrots, shoot lasers.
Right on. Peace, guys.